Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another interview here on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Lee Pierce. I am an assistant professor of rhetoric here in New York, and I am very excited today to welcome Ruby Hamad, who is the author of the critically acclaimed book, White Tears, Brown Scars, How White Feminism Betrays Women of Color, which came out last year from Catapult Press. Taking us from the slave era when white women fought in court to keep, quote, ownership of their slaves, through centuries of colonialism to the modern workplace, White Tears, Brown Scars tells the story of white women's active participation in campaigns of oppression. It offers a long overdue validation of the experiences of women of color. It discusses everything from the Hunger Games and AOC to Barbecue Becky, and Hamad undertakes a new investigation through these different case studies of gender and race, showing how the division between innocent white women and racialized, sexualized women of color was created and why this division is crucial to confront. Hamad builds a powerful argument about the legacy of white superiority that we are socialized within, a reality that we must apprehend in order to fight. And with that, I hope you enjoy the interview. Ruby, are you there?
I am here.
Well, awesome. Well, thanks for joining us. You're over in Sydney, Australia, where it's morning. So glad
I am indeed. And yes, it is. So thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, of course. So I told the audience a little bit about the book just from a very broad overview. Do you want to tell us more about yourself and how you came to write the book and what you think some of the big themes and takeaways are for someone who hasn't read it yet?
Sure, of course. So I'm a writer, journalist, and now a PhD candidate. So,
well, hey, congrats!
I say and now. I've actually been doing it 3 years, although it's kind of been on and off because I did take time off to write this book. Sure. So I've been working as a columnist and a features journalist for, gosh, about 10 years in Australia before I wrote the book. And yeah, obviously being a columnist, wrote a lot about feminism, a lot about race. Although I did write a lot about anything, I wrote a lot about other things, and it's interesting how they tend to get a lot sort of less traction, a lot less interest. And then when you write about race and feminism, everyone's like, why is everything about gender? Why is everything about race? It's like, well, because you don't listen, you know, you don't even look at my other stuff. But anyway, right. I'm going off on a tangent there. But yes, yeah, so this book was inspired by, or came out of, an essay I wrote for Guardian Australia, which then was picked up by Guardian in the US and the UK. And so it went viral. And so that article was called How White Women Use Strategic Tears to Silence Women of Color. So, you know, it was from 2018. And at that point, this, you know, this concept of white women's tears wasn't as in the public sort of, you know, conscious as much as it is now. So it did create quite a big stir, and, you know, positive and negative, as things tend to do. But it had such an impact on other women of color around the world that I did have a lot of them, by which I mean dozens, contacting me, asking me to essentially keep the conversation going. right? So the perspective was you've kind of like set off like a bomb almost in sort of this white space, as you know, we've been the Guardian being a, you know, major newspaper, and they wanted the conversation to keep going so that it wouldn't die down again. And I remember thinking, gosh, like I would never have thought I'd write a book on this. Is this really a book? Could there be a book here? So, you know, I started doing if I was to write a book, what would I focus on? And I did a little bit of research, and then I just thought, oh yeah, no, there is. So that's literally how it came about. Like I, for me, that was one article, and that was, you know, I just wanted to bring some, you know, highlight an issue I thought wasn't getting talked about enough. And yeah, it led to this. And so what I do in the book is look at how the construction of womanhood and white womanhood versus, you know, black womanhood versus Arab womanhood versus Indigenous womanhood, how that concept was used to not only rationalize and justify, you know, colonialism, violence against non-white peoples, but how it really became a foundational, you know, aspect of Western society.
Yeah, and the book really has an excellent historical, right, because you kind of start with a very current example, which was a white journalist after Charlottesville. When Trump said, you know, there are the classic line, right? There are good people on both sides. And then you move into, you know, Jezebels and exotic Orientals and Pocahontas and all of these colonial tropes of black and brown femininity that have set up white fragility and white tears to be so persuasive as a public tactic. So it's interesting to draw those lines of connection, because you do see how long this has been going on, right? It's not a social media phenomenon. It's historical through and through.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think a lot of people have sort of made the argument that it's just media sensationalism, and it's like, well, no, this is a long standing strategy of white violence for sure. So, do you want to maybe start with that and maybe the Fox News example, or just whatever you think kind of gets us into this illustration fastest? Just for I just like to be sensitive to readers who haven't had a chance to dig through the book or listeners rather.
That's okay. So with the Fox News example, I chose that one for two reasons. One is that it's an example of this phenomenon in a conservative environment, a conservative setting, because, you know, the subtitle of my book being How White Feminism Betrays Women of Color. So I wanted to set also that this extends beyond feminism, beyond, you know, progressivism, of course. And the other reason being that I think such an informative example of the way in which, you know, a white woman's distress has so much potency, you know, so much cultural potency, cultural currency, that even in a conversation about race and racism occurring at a time where, it was that sort of white supremacist violence was coming to the fore, where black people and other people of color had every right to be distressed, had every right to be angry and frustrated. Even in that environment, her distress was what sort of everyone was responding to, and implicitly or explicitly attempting to soothe. And now, whether that was because of, you know, sort of genuinely wanting to soothe her, or whether the realization that arguing with her and distressing her further is actually going to work against them. It's the question that I wanted to the audience to be, or the reader to be thinking as they sort of proceed through the book. So, because you know, that conversation, her tears. What was the journalist's name again? My bad. It's been a while since
Faulkner is her last name.
The
woman journalist of color, Harris Faulkner, and then I think it is
Melissa Francis, right?
Melissa Francis, who's the white.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So So I just want to set that up for the listener.
Sure.
So Melissa Francis being, that's okay. Melissa Francis being the white journalist is so, because she was challenged. She was challenged and I guess called out by her colleagues saying, you're kind of defending Trump here. And so she got upset or became visibly upset and saying, this is really hard. And, you know, not everyone here is, essentially saying that what was distressing about this issue is that she was being told that she was defending Trump. So the whole conversation became about her distress. And it was no longer about what Trump said. It was no longer about the protests that was going on, about the violence that had occurred in North Carolina. So it just kind of shut everything down, and it was just like, wow. So that's why I chose that particular piece. Was a very sort of a public example, but one that had been, it was discussed at the time, but by the time I wrote the book, it had been a few years. So I sort of wanted to recollect it.
Well, and it's illustrative too, because the co-host, one of Harris's co-hosts, one of Melissa Francis's co-hosts, Harris Faulkner, is a black woman. And so,
yes,
of course, now she's in this position of having to not only not express her own emotions, but also in not necessarily comfort, but certainly not do any more damage. And you actually write, what should be remarkable about this clip is that it is the black woman who remains stoic and almost expressionless, while the white woman is freely emotional and teary. And of course, right, because even she has to be backed into a corner to prioritize the comfort of this white woman, because it's so conditioned that that's how we react.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was really helpful. I mean, it was, I hadn't heard about the incident. So it was, I think, just a great place to enter into the argument, for sure.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. And I mean, that is still available online. So I recommend, it's a short clip, a couple of minutes long. I do recommend if people hop onto YouTube and look for it, because it really is, it's quite disturbing to see how calm Faulkner had to stay, knowing she had to stay calm when she's talking what is essentially a matter of life and death for black people.
And then you tell this interesting story about how the book came to be. I don't know if you want to recount this before you kind of hop into this first part of the book, where you talk about how colonialism rigged the game against women of color. So would you like to go there, or do you want to talk a little bit about this exchange you had with another journalist about getting the book off the ground?
It wasn't necessarily with other journalists. I had a Twitter account then, and I no longer
Twitter,
do.
That's true, yeah.
It was women on Twitter. Because, a lot of people on Twitter don't use their real names, so I don't, and it's fine. It wasn't, but it was just, those days when that article came out, it's all a haze because I was getting so much thrown at me. But I do remember a lot of women of color sort of, saying, well, what are you going to do next? At first I was like, well, what do you mean? Like, I've written the piece and now I'm going back to my PhD. But I did feel, and I don't mean this in a burdensome way, I felt that it became a responsibility or an obligation on me to do it, because, okay, well, if I've written this article, it's clearly struck many nerves. And I am in a position now, if I write further on this, I probably will get the opportunity to publish a book on it that other women of color may not. I probably will, be listened to by some. And I felt that I did have a duty to do that, because, it's all part of the, giving back, I guess. And like, what are you, why are you in this for? Why do you write for? The people that you're writing and speaking to, and who, have shared this experience with you, if they're writing back to you and they're saying, please keep this going, then I felt that I should. But I was a bit, I was really worried, because I was like, how, I don't want to write a book just for the sake of it. Is this all going to be padding? Is it all? So what I did is I went back to the article And I thought, right, read this article as if it's not yours and look at it and what jumps out at you, what is happening underneath that you think this is really about. And so when I read it, I read, you know, the things that really jumped out at me is, you know, where I said, you know, Arab women, and then that was a standing for all non-white women, Arab women are, you know, whether we're angry or calm, whether we're shouting or pleading, we're always perceived as the aggressors. I talk about, you know, the trope of the Arab terrorist and, you know, the white damsel in distress trope and the angry black woman trope. And I thought, okay, this is a, you know, this is a story of archetypes. So this is a story of how we're so limited by these archetypes that precede us that when people speak to us or we're in a conflict with them, we're not even really even talking to each other or seeing each other. We're seeing this caricature, this archetype. So then I thought, well, then I have to see where this came from, right? Like, how can it be so strong that we actually, you know, we build our world around it, essentially. So yeah, that's how that, so that when I did that, that's when I thought, okay, this definitely can be a book, because it's not just talking about this dynamic, this sort of this interactions between white women and non-white women. We're looking at this history of how is it that white women come to be seen this way? How is it that, you know, brown women and black women have come to be seen the way that they do? And why is it so strong, like so potent that, you know, it leads to, you know, the situation that I talk about in the article?
Yeah, I mean, well, I can't even imagine what that emotions were like with all those. And you tell the story of Lisa, I believe her last name is Benson, who was a journalist her white colleagues accused her of creating a hostile atmosphere after she started telling people about this article.
Yes.
That you had written.
Sorry, that's who you were referring to earlier. See, I don't think I explained that very well in the book. I just mean that interaction with her wasn't. The book was already in the works then. I didn't have the book deal yet, but I was working on the proposal, so that was already happening. But I know I see what you mean now. It does perhaps.
But it is still an illustration of how.
Oh, absolutely.
Insulated, yes. Right? That you can bring up this article and then be accused of creating a hostile work environment. I mean, the hypocrisy is alarming.
It perfectly demonstrated it. And it was really it was really shocking. Maybe it shouldn't have been, but it was. And it was awful because, you know, I was like, oh, my goodness, I thought I was doing something good in writing this. Is this topic so taboo? Is it so non-approachable that I'm actually going to be doing more harm than good?
Oh, interesting.
That was what went through my mind with that because it was like, this is absolutely, you know, a woman losing her job or her contract over it. So that is what my first thought was. But then of course I'm thinking, okay, this, don't make it, you know, about your feelings. So I was having conversations because I said I wanted to do, you know, something useful, not something that would hurt people, but I the conversations with her, and then I scatter her story a little bit throughout the book, and that, I mean, she has no regrets with it, and it's led her to a new place in her life where she now, runs workshops and consultancy on sort of race in the workplace in the US. So it's given her a whole new purpose in her life. And
I can't speak obviously to the experience. Yeah, but I give this to students in my class, to read, and many of them will write me, the students of color, because we're at a predominantly white institution, because, you know, the white tears are such a control mechanism, because they seem benign and genuine, and you have this great line, I wish I highlighted, that just because something is genuine doesn't mean it's not also, I can't remember what you say, but essentially, you do feel it is genuine, but that feeling is still culturally conditioned and historically driven, right?
Yeah.
It's not to say you're being disingenuous, but you can be genuine and still participate in oppression.
Yeah, I know know the line that you're referring to.
Yeah,
actually.
I just didn't highlight it. I wish I had.
Yeah, that's okay. But it's just they may well be genuine, but that doesn't mean they're legitimate, I think is the word
I use. Yeah, legitimate. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And so what I meant by that was they, you know, the white woman in a scenario may well be upset and really genuinely distressed, but is she distressed because she's been misunderstood, or is she distressed because she feels that this woman, this other woman, this, you know, woman of color is not, you know, supplicating herself enough? Is she distressed because she feels that the racial, you know, this unspoken racial hierarchy is being transgressed?
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, being upset can have different, what is the word, you know, propellers. Like, so
yeah,
that's what I was getting at with that.
Well, then the book moves into sort of some historical context, and you actually start with an anecdote from the Hunger Games, which is also mentioned in an interview that just happened on the New Books Network with Ebony Thomas about The Dark Fantastic, where she talks about racism in the imaginary and when everyone was upset about Rue from the Hunger Games being cast as a black character, and all of the people hopping onto those fan boards to be kind of outraged that they hadn't imagined her as black. They'd imagined her as white.
Yeah.
And so they were upset that the character had been recast. And you pull that into a longstanding history of, you know, European Christian colonialism. And so what are some examples from this chapter or specific historical figures that you think are particularly the American plantation mistress? You talk about her and we've been taught that white women are constantly under siege by, you know, black threats, things like that.
Yeah. So I started that chapter, as you mentioned, the title, Lou Jezebel's Exotic Orientals, Princess Pocahontas, How Colonialism Rigged the Game Against Women of Color. So when I right away, I wanted to go into the construction of these archetypes. And I started with that, the Hunger Games, because it's something I remember quite clearly. It's almost a decade now, but it was one of the first sort of, you know, those sort of Twitter, social media sort of outrages. But what stuck out to me at the time and why I revisited is that the incredulity that, and these were young people, right? Young fans of fiction were showing was so, it wasn't sort of furtive. It, you know, maybe some were a bit sheepish, but they were so open in expressing that they felt in some way betrayed. That it's just, you know, it's quite astonishing, and that how free they felt to come out and say that it doesn't seem right that a young black girl is cast in a role where the character is innocent and lovable. And it's quite astonishing. So I wanted to trace that back. So to show, you know, to lead back into the history of that construction, and to show how young it starts for women of color, and in that specific instance for black women. And I started with that as well, and obviously that the historical construction is what they call the Jezebel, the black Jezebel, which comes from the slavery era. And I chose that one first, and then I go into archetypes of other racialized women of different backgrounds. But I put that one in first because I it's almost like that was the prototype for all the others, all the others, like that, you know, the East Asian China doll, the exotic, Oriental women is almost comes. Although the exotic Oriental woman did exist before the Jezebel, however, it was probably more benign. It wasn't until colonialism, until slavery, that it was used to rationalize colonialism. Well, funnily enough. So yeah, so essentially, like, you know, the Black Jezebel was this, it was a construction of Black women, and let's be clear, it was enslaved Black women, as being promiscuous and easy to mm-hmm. rationalize the sexual abuse of enslaved Black women. And it's that, you know, like, it's just that, it's simple and horrific at the same time. And the after effects of that is, as I said, this ongoing perception that's implicit and pervasive of Black women as lacking in all kinds of innocence, including sexual innocence, even as children. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I discuss, you know, studies like the George Washington study of how Black girls are pushed into adulthood really early. They're just seen as almost fully grown women. You know, by the time they're like 8 or 10, like, and it's quite it's so pervasive and yet has been so unspoken for so long. But it just becomes sort of implicitly understood, and then it explodes every once in a while, which is how it exploded in that, you know, the Hunger Games example. And so the Black Jezebel was the foil the white mistress was the foil for the Black Jezebel, right? So you have this construction right. of the virtuous, chaste, moral, you know, fully clothed, heavily clothed, white mistress, who was mm-hmm. the antithesis of the Black Jezebel and the white mistress, as long as she was, you know, existed, really, as long as that archetype existed and was protected, then it's almost sort of served as this this absolution and this rationalization for all of the horrors of slavery.
Yeah.
And from that, from other, you know, colonial experience in other countries that were colonized by the West or by Europe.
Yeah, one of the things that's really interesting about this first section is you have to cut across a lot of different stereotypes that are not all exclusively one group or another, right? Because Jezebels and Orientals and Pocahontas, I mean, you're talking about indigenous women and brown women and Arab women. So was this hard? Did you see a lot of similarities? Did you have to oversimplify things, or did you just focus on what was in common? Because I thought you kind of pointed out the particulars and the generalities really well, but was it difficult to try to bring all of these into to common point here?
No, see, when I was first sort of, you know, structuring, you know, the book and, you know, writing, okay, oh, what this chapter might be about, what this chapter was, I knew that I was going in and that I was going to be discussing what the main, you know, stereotypes and obstacles for women of color are, depending on what their racial and ethnic group is. What I wasn't expecting, because I knew that we all had our specific struggles, but what I wasn't expecting was how similar they were.
Interesting.
And it was the similarity, obviously executed to different degrees, sort of brutality and marginalization and effectiveness, but they were similar in their impetus and just this in their construction. And it was the similarities that then compelled me to put them together in the same chapters. And so
interesting.
I, you know, in the setup, and I called it part one, the setup, because it's the setup both in how, you know, colonialism set women up, but also I'm setting up the second half of the book.
Right.
And there was so, like, I ended up spending a lot more time on the history than I really originally envisaged, just because it was so rich and it was just so fundamental to why or to how women are still perceived today, that I felt that it needed a deeper discussion, and that's then why I then split it up into two chapters. So the first chapter, so you have, you know, the Jezebels, exotic Orientals, the China dolls. Those are the sexual, submissive, promiscuous archetypes. And then the chapter following that, which is the the angry sapphires, bad Arab dragon ladies. So that's where the angry, the cunning, the untrustworthy, deceptive, sexually deceptive stereotypes and archetypes of women of color came in. And what I found that was fascinating, like looking at that history, is that the promiscuous stereotypes, and they correspond to the beginnings of colonialism and, you know, and slavery, and sort of justifying the spread of the West and the, mm-hmm. you know, the European colonialism, and then for a short time sustaining it. And then when, you know, decolonization movement started to become stronger, when the colonized began to resist, that's when the angry, violent, threatening archetypes became, you know, came into play. Right. And that's why I did them in their own chapters. And so these are things I wasn't expecting to find. I wasn't expecting to see those fundamental similarities. And I wasn't expecting to see how these archetypes were constructed and to correspond with these moments in history of European colonialism and of resistance movements of, you know, different groups of racialized people. It was really, really fascinating to me, and I actually just thought I could write a whole book. You could write a book on just one, you know, but obviously I had to write it in a way that it stays in keeping with the impetus of the book, which is to look at this dynamic between white women and women of color in when they're in a conflict. Why does it tend to almost always play out the way that it does?
So, well, and it's a helpful historical frame for sure, because you know, now that it's become certainly, like, it's become a little more tricky, let's say, to specifically invoke these stereotypes outright, but you can still invoke their inverse, which is white fragile femininity. So even though people aren't saying angry black women the way that they might have been in the 60s, the fact that you're invoking the opposite is still doing that work. And I couldn't have seen that, I don't think, if I hadn't had the context.
Oh, yes, thank you. And that's exactly right, though. You put it really well, in that by those, you know, the distress, you know, what I call it, you know, the distress of the damsel automatically triggers those perceptions of racialized women, of women of color, without having to say it. So as soon as that happens, what I wanted to show is that it's these archetypes, these representations have just been so relentless and so pervasive for so long, they've just become like the air we breathe. You know, what's the analogy about the fish in the water? You no longer see it, right? A fish doesn't see the water, it just is. And this is the power that, you know, that art, that literature, that music, that drama, as well as politics, has they feed and buttress and perpetuate each other, so that it just becomes, you know, natural to see people in certain ways without even having to vocalize it.
Right. Yeah. And that sort of leads us well into the second part of the book, the payoff, which you mean both in the sense it's the payoff of the argument, and that this is the payoff that white power gets from setting up all these historical stereotypes.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon,
shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You say that there is no sisterhood of white women and racism. And I thought this was an important claim and probably one of maybe the least popular I can imagine of the book, that the fact that white women and black women share women doesn't mean that they have an equal stake in the struggle of the sisterhood, quote unquote, because you argue that white women can move out of certain boxes, right? Because they can always invoke whiteness, but black women can't invoke anything outside of being a black woman. So can you, do you say a little bit more about this section and what you think the contribution is here?
So what I was getting at there and is that, and I've become a lot clearer on what I think there since then, you know, speaking about it.
That's how it goes,
Yes, I understand. So what I was getting at there is that, so, you know, like Western feminism, mainstream Western feminism, you know, white feminism looks at patriarchy and gender as like the master oppression that all women have in common. Mm-hmm. And I would argue, and I didn't say it outright then in the book, but it is leading to this, is that that would be so until colonialism and the success of European colonialism, because what European colonialism did is to give, it gave white women a stake in, you know, whiteness in colonialism outside of their gender, so, and into their race. So when a woman has a means of power and accessing power that enables her to exercise that power over other women, then that is going to fracture any idea of a collective sisterhood. And you can't, you know, to move in and out of it is how, you know, one of the ways in which white feminism has always functioned and sustained itself, in that it will be like, yes, women, we're fighting against, you know, male violence and patriarchy. But when any victory happens, it's going to be the white women who mostly, if not exclusively, benefits from that, because then she steps into that whiteness. So to me, colonialism changed everything. And that's why looking at oppression of women only through that prism of gender and, you know, patriarchy is, it's inhibiting an actual, it's inhibiting an understanding of how power and oppression functions in the West and now across the world, right? So that is why there can't be a sisterhood, because it's whiteness essentially gets in the way, is what I'm getting at. That because white women and white feminists throughout history, as I discuss in that part of the book, have worked with white men to suppress and oppress other women. And not only that, they've actively appealed to powerful white men and saying, we will help you. We will help, you know, the spread of the power of the white man, the white race. We will, you know, giving us the right to vote, giving us, you know, more powerful jobs outside of the home is not going to it's not going to weaken white rule. It's actually going to strengthen it. And they stay true to their words. So examples I give is the in Australia and the American West is the taking of Indigenous children, which was not only, you know, Margaret Jacobs talks about this as a historian, and not only did they was it mostly white women who physically took the children? But in Australia in particular, they constructed that, like they presented their role to white men, and as in white men in power, as this is a job for women, mm-hmm. and we can do this better than you, and we'll help the spread of civilization because we'll take these children, we'll raise them better, and they will eventually come, you know, they'll basically become useful to white society, to capitalism. And so that's what the children, you know, they were taken, and, you know, the Indigenous girls were taken to be domestic servants and Indigenous boys became labourers, right? So they became commodified in, you know, for capitalism and to, you know, facilitate the attempt to sort of destruction of Indigenous cultures, Indigenous families. So it's not just a matter of white feminists don't think about other women enough. It's, you know, along every step of the way, they've actively leveraged for their emancipation and their, you know, against their subordination by, you know, who are proverbially throwing other women under the bus and basically driving over them with it. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, and you mentioned multiple movements for women's suffrage, and you mentioned the book by it's Claire Wright about Australia's yes. suffragist movement, and it's yeah. in which, you know, Indigenous women were very specifically sacrificed to make the movement palatable Absolutely. For white men. Yeah, and it happened yeah. in America, and then we saw it again in 2017 with the Women's March. How many black right. and brown women's voices were silenced? Yeah.
So we're always surprised, right? Yeah. Like, you know, we were surprised by how many white women voted for Trump in 2016, and then even more voted in 2020. So what mm-hmm. I was trying to get at is, like, we need to stop being surprised at this, because this is what history is has set us up for. Right. And in that, you know, how yeah, you have this idea of a sisterhood, but when you look at the history of Western society and colonialism, true womanhood was presented as something that only the white woman can have. So right. how can we be sisters when I'm told I'm being a woman of color, told that I'm not even really a woman, right? Right. So that, to me, has to be addressed. This chasm, this gulf that colonialism deliberately constructed between white women and all other women, until that's addressed, then it's always going to exist, even though we're attempting to, you know, whatever, plant flowers over it, it's there. And that is what makes the, you know, this idea of a true sort of global sisterhood completely, well, it's, you know, it's a historical, and it's just not, it's not in any way a real sort of representation of the reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And this brings us into some new terms, actually. I mean, I'd heard of class washing before, but not the way. So in chapter 7, you title it The Rise of Righteous Racism. And in this chapter, you talk about class washing and the mm-hmm. Lovejoy trap. And I would love mm-hmm. for you to tell us a little bit more about those two, because I think they're rhetorical strategies, for lack of a better word, or media strategies or whatever, through which this stuff gets enacted. And I don't know that a lot of people would pick up on this as easily. I mean, I think it's easy now to look and say, like, oh, the dragon lady stereotype. But what you don't realize is that stereotype has been replaced now with new ways. And I think that'd be helpful for our listeners to maybe, as like frameworks for them to wonder, where do they see this and where are they doing it? So do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about sure. class washing and the Lovejoy?
So class washing, I first came up with, and I'm sure other people have used it as well, but it's one of those words that I'm just like, wow, I'm brilliant, but also I'm pretty sure I can't be the first person who has said this, gaslighting being another. But anyway, class washing, I first referred to it a few years ago in the context of Australian politics, and just and so I use it to refer. It's a kind of a double, I don't know, not so much a double-edged sword, but it has double meanings within how it's used by white people, white society. Mm-hmm. So you have class washing as in shut down or to minimize discussions and arguments about racism by presenting the working class as, you know, class is the real issue. So presenting this in much the same way that, you know, white feminism tries to present gender and feminism as sort of uniting all women, mm-hmm. Class is presented the same way as, right. Well, this is, you know, this is what we all have in common, regardless of our race and other marginalizations. So this is what we should focus on. But that obviously does not take into account how class hits different people differently, depending on their racial background, depending on their gender identity, you know, and other marginalizations as well. And then the other aspect of class washing is that it essentially blames, whether it's explicitly or implicitly, blames racism on the working class, because that's right. Where all these arguments of, well, it's not educated, or we just have to talk, we just tell them. But then they're presenting racism as this kind of this problem of lack of money, lack of social status, lack of education. But then once again, you look at the statistics of who voted for Trump, and so many of them were college educated. So mm-hmm. you see that these fall down in that, and so on the one hand, it's like excusing working class white people for any racism, but then also kind of blaming them and saying it's right. Right. It's just because so it's this weird sort of double effect. Class washing, it prevents an understanding of the way in which class is used. I think Stuart Hall referred to it as, you know, it's the modality through which race is lived.
Right.
Again, you go back to the history, and that working class white people were not considered to be part of white society. So whiteness wasn't just about, you know, to be white, to be European derived was necessary. It was a necessary criteria for being part of white society, but it wasn't sufficient.
Right.
Working class white people, sex workers, or white women who were not sex workers but who stepped outside of their function as, you know, the virtuous representation of whiteness, they would be kicked out. Mm-hmm. It's very much a construction in that way. Class washing essentially washes all that history away, and it washes away that understanding how class is utilized to perpetuate and to solidify racial oppressions.
And the other thing I like about this is also in this chapter, it's also that this idea that racism goes away with class mobility is wrong. Is that right? And one thing, you know, and one thing we've seen from the studies is that upwardly mobile Black women, especially Black and brown women, do not experience significant reductions in preventable illness, right? Because racism is still so much the same, whether you make $100,000 a year. And I'm not certainly not slighting the fact that money, you know, income and upper mobility matter, but the idea that they eradicate racism is very much exposed as a myth in this part of the chapter.
No, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and it'll for sure, you know, provides a greater buffer, mm-hmm. but it's something that can very, very easily be ripped away and undermined. Yeah. So and in the same, you know, by the same token, being upwardly mobile for white people isn't going to make racial attitudes go away.
Yeah,
unless those issues are dealt with.
And then piggybacking on that, then what is the Lovejoy trap?
Right. So that's I came up with that too, because well, you know, Helen Lovejoy in The Simpsons, being, you know, her that famous meme where she's, you know, lets out this sort of this faux anguished yell and won't someone think of the children? Mm-hmm. And so the idea being there is that we use children as a, God, what's the right word? Sometimes I can't think of right words on the fly, but
that's okay. It's difficult.
We use children as proxies, right? Mm-hmm. To actually promote or to present our own personal agendas, and so there's this, the, you know, we enact or we perform concern for children, even when the matter that we're discussing isn't about, you know, children or isn't directly concerned with the welfare of children, and it's a bait and switch essentially. Mm-hmm. So I call it a trap because when how it's used in the context of women of color, all people of color really, but you know the book focuses on women of color, is that it'll shut you down by turning it back on you and saying, well, you just don't care about the children, you don't care about women. So example of, you know, being I think, you know, I start off the chapter, I talk about an incident on Australian TV. You know, we have a big thing every year in Australia about Australia Day, you know, which they say is the equivalent of July 4th, but it's not really, because January 26th is the date that, you know, the first fleet, the first ship of convicts from England came to mm-hmm. this continent and began, you know, the colonization. So you know, there's this idea of celebrating that day as supposedly this sort of this unifying celebration for all of us. And so, you know, the protests against Australia Day led by, you know, Indigenous activists get bigger every year.
Yeah.
And so obviously there's always going to be a backlash as well. So this incident on TV with this white woman, and it wasn't an Indigenous woman, it was another brown woman who you know, they're sort of given the back and forth, and then, you know, the white woman, Kerry Ann Kennelly, who's a host, long-time host on Australian TV, said, well, you know, do you care about the you know, trigger warning here, do you care about the woman you know, and children who were being raped in those remote communities, five-year-olds being raped, etc. So she's getting at that. What she's saying is the biggest threat to Indigenous women are actually Indigenous men.
Indigenous men, yeah.
She's saying, right?
Right, right.
And so that to me is what I talk about when I say the Lovejoy trap, because they were talking about Australia Day, which again, the movement against it led by Indigenous activists, and it turned around and basically said, well, what about the children? Why aren't you, if that was not the, that's absolutely not pertinent in that discussion. But what it did is that bait and switch, it put the focus on the other woman whose name is Jimmy Steins, essentially telling her, no, look, you're the one who doesn't care about Aboriginal women, and you're the one who doesn't care about Aboriginal children, because if you really did, you wouldn't be wasting time talking about Australia Day. You'd be talking about what's happening in these remote communities. So that's what I mean about that. And, you know, so it's used in other contexts, you know, as well, with like to justify the war in Afghanistan, right? It's part of women's rights. We have to liberate the women. So it becomes about the only time, I think the only time that white society seems to find its moral compass when it comes to the abuse of non-white women is when they can use it as a justification for intervening in their communities,
right?
And when that abuse is said to be coming from the men, non-white men within their own racial groups.
Yeah, I feel very similar about the only time that white America seems to care about black underprivileged children is when it gives them an excuse to like take them away or mass incarcerate their parents. And,
even like it's that, you know, like, so whenever in the US, like when the discussions of police brutality are on the table.
Yes, very similar.
Right? What is a counter argument, which is not even really a counter argument? You'll start to hear about, well, what about black on black crime?
Yes, right.
You know? Okay, right. We're not talking about that. Like, you know, everyone is more likely to, you know, if they're going to be, you know, the victim of violent crime, it's most likely going to be someone within their racial group anyway. But even so, that's not the discussion that we're having. So it's a bait and switch. And but it's a bait and switch that's not only does it divert the conversation, it does so in such a way that it makes you, as in being the person who is, you know, say talking about racism, it makes you seem like the person who's morally deficient, right? So that's what I mean about the rise of righteous racism. It's like, not only am I being really racist, I'm going to do it in such a way that actually makes me look like the good guy and you look like the bad guy. That's, you know, and that's why I call it a trap, because as soon as a bait and switch like that is pulled, it's, you can't, you know, so to go back to that example I gave on the TV, so they're talking about Australia Day, then as soon as, you know, the white host said something about the communities, you know, what have you done for those remote communities, that it should have just been steered back, or we should just look at it as steered, that's not what we're talking about today. As soon as you try to defend yourself from that, you've basically taken the bait, because they don't, you know, it's not really about their that, it's about not having the discussion that should be had, if that makes sense. So that's why I call it a trap. And Lovejoy, again, you know, named after Helen Lovejoy, because I was just seeing it so much. So, well, what about it? These children, and you don't care about those children, and they use it as the same, you know, for women as well. Like, you know, if you really cared about women's rights, you'd go to Saudi Arabia. That sort of, you know, like that kind of a thing.
Right.
It's like, as in, you'd go, you know, be a feminist in Saudi Arabia. It's that kind of this bait and switch of making themselves look like the good guy.
This was really helpful, and I one of the things, you know, about a good book is then you start to see things everywhere. So in the 2 months since I finished reading this, I've seen this Lovejoy trap happen at least 10 times. So it's cool because it's from The Simpsons, so it's
So thank you for asking me about it too. It's actually, that's one of those little things in the book, well, you know, so little things, but one of the things in the book I was quite, you know, proud of, you know, in that I felt like it should be given a name, because it's a definite, you know, it's a tool that's used of shutting down, you know, really important movements and conversations by, you know, sort of trying to make the person who's concerned about inequality be the one who's morally, you know, lacking.
Unfortunately, we're kind of running up on time, and I know that people love shorter interviews with the average commute's 20 minutes, so we try to keep it to 45. That means you can listen to half on the way in, half on the way home. But I would like to get to the conclusion, which you've just titled Brown Scars, and you reiterate this idea that what you say white feminism is an arm of empire or something to that effect, and you just reiterate this idea that it's a very specific technique of colonialism and empire that acts itself out even when we all are sitting around thinking how post-colonial we are. And I don't know if you want to say anything else about the book or
I think I said white womanhood is the maternal art of
womanhood
empire.
That's right.
And
that's
then right. And then I say, and white feminism is not immune to this. So white feminism has inherited, and so what I get at in that chapter and entitling it Brown Scars is what I'm saying is that the cost, you know, the cost of white tears is brown scars, and you know, use poetic license there, obviously. I mean, all people of color in that. So you have this distressed of whiteness, you know, this wounded victim presentation, but the harm is not, you know, the damage is not being done to white people. The damage is being done to non-white people. And that, you know, that this is, to me, it's the sort of the fundamental issue, the problem with white feminism and all sort of, I think, all political movements in the West is that none of them sufficiently address this. None of them sufficiently address not only the way in which white movements were able to progress at our expense of people of color, but in the way that any attempt to raise that then becomes an opportunity to perform white victimhood and mm-hmm. to prevent these discussions from happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly powerful book. It's historically contextualized, which is so helpful. The examples are really illustrative, and I just can't thank you enough for all it must have taken to write this, especially after what I imagine was a pretty tumultuous and also rewarding and also probably unpleasant at times experience after that article went viral.
It was a wild time for sure, and it was one of those things. I just kind of, you know, if I stopped too much to really think about it, I would have not been able to keep going. Having to write it fairly quickly and be just, yeah, with, because I was kind of living it in real time. Like I was living the backlash and the effects, still, keeping in touch with, you know, Lisa Benson to see how her court case is going out. You know, so all of this stuff was happening in real time, while I was also trying to write about the history of it. So, but look, you know, and I'm really glad it's gotten out to people. And so I thank you for, you know, reading and talking about it with me.
Yeah, of course. Well, and so for everyone listening, I just want to remind you that the title of the book is White Tears, Brown Scars, A White Feminism Betrays Women of Color. And it is from Catapult Books, which mm-hmm. has produced a bunch of really great stuff. I'm like working through their catalog now. And, you know, we want to support independent presses like Catapult and work like Ruby's. So if you're so inclined, definitely pick up a copy of the book for yourself or pick up one from a friend. We recommend you head over to the Catapult website or to bookshop.org, which is an alternative to those of us who used to buy our books on Amazon. And if that's mm-hmm. not available to you right now, you can certainly stop into your local library, academic libraries, I think especially. I know that my college students have really appreciated this book. And put in a request to see if they would pick up a copy to put into circulation so other people can get access to the ideas. Again, to support work like this so it gets out to more people. And with that, Ruby, are you up to anything new? Are you doing any virtual speaking tours anybody might want to know about? Or is there anywhere people can connect with you if they want to keep up with your work?
So right now I'm bogged down in my
PhD. I remember those days. Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And so that's, you know, is my main focus. I am, you know, the only social media platform I have is Instagram. Because, you know, it's the least rowdy. So
yeah, right, exactly.
You know, and so, yeah, find me there, Ruby Hammard Writer. And I'm still, you know, working on my website, which has been, you know, my stock answer for a long time now. But I am actually literally working on it now.
Well, Instagram will work until then, right?
Instagram works, yeah. So that's it. So, like, you know, the book's been out since late last year. So I've done the speaking engagements for it. But when I do have something else coming up, I will put it on my Instagram. So that's why you can find it there.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, take lots of breathing space for that PhD. I mean, you've already basically written a dissertation as far as I'm concerned. So hopefully.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, I've actually changed the question because of this book, but I won't get into that. So,
oh, okay.
Because
well,
we have to go now.
Now I want to nerd out about that, but I won't abuse the audience with my esoteric PhD inquisitive. Well, we wish you the best of luck with everything.
Thank you so much
for coming on the book. Yeah. And to everyone at home, please check out the book on your own or, again, have a copy requested. I mean, I can't tell you how important it is. And even if the book maybe evokes a little bit of guilty, bad feelings, remember that those might be coming from places that you don't really want to be acting from. And with that, we'll say goodbye and farewell. And everyone take care and be good to each other.